Hello and welcome to A Good Science Read with me, Professor Frances Ashcroft. My guest today is Sir Charles Godfrey, Professor of Population Biology at the University of Oxford and Director of the Oxford Martin School and the Oxford Martin Programme on the Future of Food. He is also a Fellow of the Royal Society and of Balliol College. Charles, welcome to A Good Science Read.
Great pleasure to be here, Fran.
The first book we're going to discuss is The Flytrap by the Swedish author Fredrik Sjöberg. At this point, I should apologise to all Swedes for my pronunciation of the author's name. It's notoriously difficult to pronounce if you're not Swedish, and my attempts to do so provoked gales of laughter from my Swedish friends. So we'll compromise and use the English pronunciation. The book describes the author's life on a remote island in the Stockholm archipelago, where he hunts for hoverflies. Charles, I know you have many interests, including food security, biodiversity and environmental science. But like Sjöberg, you're also an entomologist, although your particular passion is for a group of tiny parasitic wasps. So can you explain what hoverflies are, how we should recognise them, and what makes them and other flies so very fascinating?
Well, first of all, Fran, you're braver than me, and I think I should just refer to him as Frederick rather than attempt to the surname. What are hoverflies? Hoverflies, they'll be familiar to most people. They're flies that many of them, although not all, mimic bees. So if you go out and you look at a flower, you'll often see something that looks a bit like a bee, but the distinguishing feature, it only has a single pair of wings. All bees have two pairs of wings. And I guess in the UK, they're probably about 400 species. So they're sort of relatively species diverse, but not hugely diverse. And what I particularly like about Frederick's approach to hoverflies is he's really got to grips with one particular group of insects. And I have as well. My group of insects, as you said, are actually even more obscure than his. They're a group of tiny parasitic wasps. The big ones are 3 millimetres long. I have literally about 4 people in Europe I can talk to about them. There's no one else who studies them in the UK. And it's just enormously fun to look study them. And I really resonated with Frederick's just visceral joy and enjoyment at looking at these insects. And he sort of told me things I didn't realise about my own enjoyment and my own fascination with a particular group. So it was a book that told me a lot about myself as an individual, but also how studying one particular group informed my broader scientific study. What Frederick is a natural historian, and I consider myself to be a natural historian, as I consider myself to be a natural historian pretending to be a scientist.
Yes, I mean, how different are they? He describes 202 different species on his island, which he's seen in 7 years, and that seems to be pretty much the limit. Would you need a microscope to be able to identify them, or can you do it just by looking at them?
So towards the end of his book, he talks about the sort of growing enthusiasm for hoverflies. And the book was published 10 years ago. And he would, I'm sure he's still studying them, but in the last 10 years, that has exploded even more. And so you can buy, for example, in the UK and in most European countries, really good field guides for the hoverflies, which are very well illustrated. Now, I'm pulling these figures off the top of my head, but of the, say, 400 species, I would imagine that 250 you can recognise in the field. Another 100 or so you would need to look at under a very good hand lens or a microscope. And then there are a small number where, and forgive me for getting down into the details, you have to dissect the male genitalia before you can tell them apart. So there are some that are extraordinarily difficult, and there are some where we still don't know whether they're one or two species. And this isn't mentioned at all in the book because it's really happened in the last 10 years, But now there is a molecular biology approach to studying biodiversity, getting a very small bit of DNA, the same bit of DNA in all insects. It's called the DNA barcode locus, and sequencing that. And that has really informed the way that people look at the diversity of these groups of insects.
So I think that brings us to another topic, which is, I thought this book was a little bit like a hoverfly itself. It pauses in one place for a while and then it flits off in an entirely different direction. It's beautifully written. It's quite lyrical in places, very witty in others. It includes little anecdotes that are completely captivating. It goes into minute details about things. It's sort of partly autobiography, partly a biography of these extraordinary Swedish entomologists. And it's partly a kind of meditation on life. But as you've sort of pointed out, it's not really a popular science book. It's about natural history. So why did you choose this book for this podcast?
It is an extremely well-written book, and I really do recommend people to read it. It's quite a short book as well, so it's not War and Peace or something like that. It has this sort of elegiac style that I find really attractive. And as you say, it goes off into all sorts of interesting anecdotes, but all, I think, around a theme which sort of brings it together. I should also say that apart from one or two minor entomological lapses, he's served very well by his translator. It's translated very well. I guess why I chose it for a science, a discussion of science books, is that we know we're both biologists, although from sort of different ends of the subject. If you sort of think of biology going from molecules all the way to ecosystems. And biologists differ in the extent to which they got into the field because of natural history and because of their wonder and awe at the of the natural world. I mean, interesting to know your motivation. I know you're a keen bird watcher and gardener, so I suspect there might be a bit of the natural historian in you there. And I think it articulated to me some of the links between going out and studying the natural world. There's a passage where he talks about nature as a foreign language that you need to read. And he gives examples of how his intimate knowledge of hoverflies allows him to understand what's happening on his Swedish island. And that struck me about what I think many biologists who have a separate, strong natural history interest, how that natural history interest feeds into their science. And of course, some of the greatest biologists of all time have been very strongly that. And Charles Darwin, who discovered probably the most important theory in biology, if not in in the whole of intellectual pursuit. So he discovered that in the 1830s. And what does he do? Well, he goes away and spends 10 years studying the taxonomy of barnacles. So I'd like to think that Darwin had a bit of that in him as well.
Well, yes, I too started out life as a naturalist, not so much on birds, but on British wild orchids, which I spent long time hunting for all over Dorset and still continue to do so with a school friend. And actually, this book made me think about how we define science, the fact that you chose it, because there was a time when funding bodies funded only hypothesis-driven research, and they looked on collecting data as stamp collecting or fishing expeditions, in rather derogatory terms. But I think that's changed a bit now because, after all, something like the Human Genome Project is nothing more than collecting lots and lots of data. And I think you're right in that it's the basis of all science. It's not just what Darwin did, it's what Linnaeus did. It's what we're doing now with many different projects where we're collecting huge amounts of data. And as you say, the next step is to analyse the data to understand better about the natural world. And of course, if you happen to be brilliant, like Darwin, then you come up with some grand hypothesis as a consequence of all of that. Although I have to say that most of us never actually achieve that. We're still at the data analysis and analytical stage. But what do you think we can say that we've learnt about science from collecting hoverflies?
I would sort of widen that question to say what we have learned from collecting hoverflies and other insects. But just before answering that, go back to your point, which I think is an extremely good point, that there was a tendency at some stage to think that all science must be hypothesis driven. And often more than that, experimental as well. And I think sort of more at your end of biology, at the molecular end, then we know that the insights that can be got from the Human Genome Project, from some of the big collection of protein databases, we've seen the amazing thing, this relevant to the second book we'll discuss about AlphaFold, how it's been able to algorithmically derive the structure of many, many proteins, virtually all proteins for which a sequence has been available to a certain level. And I think that has a real lesson for taxonomy. And if you were to sort of set up our great museums, Natural History Museum, Kew Gardens, Royal Botanic Gardens, if you were to set them up today, you would set them up in a different way from what they were done in the Linnaean age, when bioinformatics was, you know, information exchange was largely literally by post. And although I have huge affection for the subject and consider myself an amateur taxonomist as well, I worry that the field has been slow to take the lessons from your end of biology, from the more molecular end of biology, and to redefine it as biodiversity informatics science, because these are the people who can navigate this really complex informational landscape. In the same way you need a nucleic acid specialist or a protein specialist to help interpret this mass of molecular data that comes through, then you need the professional taxonomist to interpret the mass of biodiversity data coming through. But not only the professional taxonomist, one of the great things about my end of the subject, far harder in yours, you can't set up a cell biology lab in your back garden, but you can do really quite substantial work, as Frederick illustrates, on the biodiversity side that feeds into the broader accumulation of valuable information.
I suppose I would add a comment there about fossil collections, because I've just been down to Dorset to see the Etches Museum, which is totally incredible. A collection of fossils made by a single man who started life as a plumber. But now, through collecting fossils and learning about them, he's got the most magnificent museum, and he actually excavated and prepared for display the giant pliosaur, which features in a film by David Attenborough. Yes. The only problem I have with this kind of collecting of flies is that, as he describes, he usually kills the flies in order to examine them and puts them on pins and mounts them in boxes, and they're sitting there for posterity. But this is the sort of collecting I don't really approve of. It's like taking birds' eggs, which is now happily banned. And it made me think of Oscar Wilde. Each man kills the thing he loves. And that's exactly what Frederick is doing all the time. And I wondered yourself, I mean, you have tiny parasitic wasps. I don't see any other way that you can examine them unless you kill them and look at them under a microscope. So how does it feel to discover that the fly or the wasp you've just caught is a really rare one, and that you may have greatly reduced the population and contributed to its extinction?
One interesting sort of trend that has happened over my lifetime is that many people who got into entomology started getting into entomology by making collections of butterflies and moths. And that has almost completely stopped. And in fact, one of the nice things was that digital cameras have become so cheap and easy to use that the collection is now not a physical collection, but it's a virtual collection, your Flickr library or whatever. I think for things like hoverflies, it's sort of on the edge there that there are many people who just collect via photographs. But for the hard ones, the one you need to really look at or dissect, then you need the specimen. And I think we just have to keep this in proportion. So the total number of insects killed by every entomologist on Earth in 1 year is less than the number of insects that a farmer will kill in an afternoon by spraying a field. So I think one has to keep it in proportion. And hopefully the insights that we will get from killing and studying a relatively small fraction of insects will feed into a better understanding of ecology, which will improve conservation and which will lead to many more insects surviving than would have done otherwise.
So long as it's not the last one of the species, like the great auk or something.
Yes, but when it gets to the last one of the species, one's really talking about the sort of well-known birds and butterflies and things. And then as a technical population biologist, then I would say that if an insect species is sufficiently endangered that it is at risk from a collector, it's not going to survive very long anyway.
It is actually interesting how many fewer insects we see these days. When I was a child, you would go for a drive and the windscreen was covered with flies. We don't ever see that now.
No, and that sort of, and I have exactly the same expression myself. In the last 10 years, there has been some really good data trying to explain that, trying to justify it. So it's not just an anecdote that there now is a good evidence base. We still do not fully know why. Habitat change is, of course, partly responsible. But it seems to be a bit more than habitat change, and we don't know why. One hypothesis is that modern insecticides are actually travel into the environment more than we imagine. But there's a lot of work going on at the moment.
I think we should probably return to the book, and quite a bit of it's about a Swedish entomologist called Malaise, who invented the eponymous flytrap, which the title refers to. So what is this flytrap and why is it so particularly special?
So this was a particular delight for me about the book. So the Malaise trap is, its technical name is an interception trap. It looks a bit like a small tent. And you put it out in the field and it catches loads of insects. It's very, very efficient. And I guess in as much as I'd ever thought about where the name Malaise trap came from, I'm not sure if I'd even realised that Malaise was a person rather than a state of mind, if you see. And if I had thought it was a person, I would have assumed he or she was French or from an Anglophone country. And so I was completely unaware that he was a Swede, a sawfly expert, an expert in many other things, and had a really extraordinary life. I mean, I suspect we could spend the rest of the podcast just recounting some of the anecdotes that Frederick does in his book. So he's a really interesting person that. I think it's delightful how Frederick goes in and sort of sorts him out. It struck me that his writing style was a bit like Chatwin, and then it was no surprise when halfway through the book he starts talking about Bruce Chatwin and some of his writing. I don't want to put non-entomological readers off, but if you're an entomologist, there is a particular nice feeling reading the book where suddenly names that you've heard about from the early 20th century, he suddenly brings to life, Malaise in great detail, other people in less detail. And I'm old enough to remember the sort of generation of entomologists who were sort of retiring in the 70s and 80s. And there were some absolutely extraordinary characters in there. And I fear, for better or for worse, modern people working in this area are a bit more ordinary than some of the characters that these people
Well, you certainly couldn't be quite like Meles. And he had these extraordinary expeditions which are described to Kamchatka and Burma and Japan and so on. And what was also fascinating to me was that the return of Meles and his wife to Sweden was a huge event with, you know, headlines and front page stories and so on, which seems absolutely amazing these days. I can't imagine that we would do such a thing. I suppose it's because, you know, now we all have access to the wonderful things all over the world through programs, television programs where we actually see them, although we don't have so much about insects.
No, and in the, I guess it's 1920, when Einstein visited the UK, it was front page news on the in the Times. I can't think of any scientist visiting the UK today that would make it to the front page.
No, I think
perhaps rightly so.
The book is really delightful, though. You're quite right, because he has so many fascinating stories. I particularly loved the one about Sansom and the lion.
Yes.
I had always thought that, you know, Sansom comes along and there is the carcass of the lion full of bees. And you, out of the strong comes forth sweetness, and you see it actually on every golden syrup
tin. Exactly, exactly.
But he points out that they probably weren't bees at all. They would be hoverflies masquerading as bees, because hoverflies actually mimic lots of other insects or look rather closely like them, like you said at the very beginning.
That was completely new to me. And actually, a few years back, I remember my wife, she was cooking something with golden syrup, and I looked at the thing and said, that's really odd. Why are there bees in the... She pointed out there was a biblical allusion. But yes, Aristaelus, the drone flies, which can feed in rotten carcasses and mimic bees.
Well, the book is full of extraordinary stories and captivating anecdotes, and it has a very surprising ending. But we probably shouldn't spoil this for the reader. Instead, we'll move on to our second book, which is As If Human, Ethics and Artificial Intelligence by Nigel Shadbolt and Roger Hampson, which discusses the ethical challenges posed by artificial intelligence. It addresses questions such as what moral principles should we endow machines with? How do we use them to empower ourselves rather than to oppress others? The authors argue that we should treat AI decisions, products and actions as if they were human. Charles, I see that the Oxford Martin School, which you direct, actually has a programme on ethical web and data architecture. So you're obviously exactly the right person to discuss this book with. I'd love to know what you think about it and what you think about the author's arguments. But let's start at the beginning. What is artificial intelligence?
So in thinking of artificial intelligence, I think you should divide it into, if I may joke, BCE and CE, where C stands for ChatGPT. So if you look at artificial intelligence, it's been around for, 50 or 60 years. People like Norbert Wiener working in the 40s and 50s were, and John von Neumann, some of the great figures in computer science and mathematics, were behind the initial thought. And the idea is, can you use computers and algorithms on computers to do things that are similar to what humans can do or beyond? And again, the other famous figure in this area is Alan Turing. And if you look at the sort of 60 years of artificial intelligence, then there was certainly progress, but it would go up and down. Nigel Shadbolt in the book quotes someone, I think, in the 1980s saying this is an area that is worth no funding whatsoever as it will lead nowhere. And I guess as time went on, then the algorithms became more and more sophisticated. We saw sort of things such as enhanced diagnosis and the beginning of image analysis for looking in medical applications. So computer computer applications that essentially made it easier for physicians to make better diagnoses. So the field was sort of increasing, going up and down and sort of getting better. And then when ChatGPT came out, which was, I'm now blanking exactly when, but only a few years back, I think everyone was amazed by just how capable it was of formulating arguments and explanations that appeared as if they'd been written by humans. And I remember talking to Nigel Shadbolt, and full disclosure, he's a good friend of mine at the time, and say, Nigel, I find this amazing. You, as someone who's worked in computer science all your life, was this something you expected? And he said, no, it is more sophisticated. It appears more human than he imagined. And ChatGPT and models like it are so-called large language models. And what large language models do is they suck in vast amounts of training data, essentially everything on the web or as much on the web that they can get out of. And then they do what is essentially very, very, very advanced statistics. So the type of regression that we learned how to do at school, where you regress Y on X so that you can predict a value of one variable, an independent variable, based on an explanatory variable, it's like that, but taken to the nth degree. So what large language models do is they have a representation of the frequency with which words appear together. And they use this, which has no semantic meaning. These large language models in no sense understand what they're doing. It's purely algorithmic, purely statistical, to be able to answer questions in ways that seem to me, and I think also to Nigel, to be extraordinarily human-like.
Well, of course, this is the problem with any new technology. We usually can't predict what's going to happen when we start out. And completely different things may occur, as you've just mentioned. I think also that the key thing about an artificial intelligence is that it can make decisions without any human intervention at the point of decision. And this is particularly true, I think, with the not just the large language models, but the essentially the programs which do machine learning, because then it's not absolutely clear how they got there or why they made that particular decision. So one of the things that the book addresses is how should we treat an artificial intelligence? Should we treat it as an alien, as a slave, as a doing our bidding, as a pet, as an animal, or as if it's human? And the authors argue that we should do it as if it's human. Would you agree with that?
I think that's a very good starting point. And the book, as you said, is entitled As If. And that's the metaphor, the leitmotif that runs throughout the book, that we should think of. We should think of the actions of a AI system as if they were human. And the authors go to great lengths to say they aren't saying it is human, but one should use the same judgments on whether it is a good a good application of AI as if it was human. Nigel, again, is one of the UK's leading computer scientists, but over his career, he's actually worked with philosophers and has a background in philosophy as well. So one of the nice things about the book is that it meshes computer science with essentially moral ethics. And he goes through different schools, the different modern schools of ethics. And he and Roger Hampson argue that actually virtue ethics are the way to think about deciding whether an AI system is behaving as we would like it to do. And this, of course, means what virtues do you then ascribe to the computer? And they say, well, obviously courage doesn't make sense, but prudence might. And I think this is a good way of arguing it. I was surprised that they chose virtue ethics, because there is another type of ethics, sort of duty ethics. There's a horrible word, deontological. And the ethics the human ethics that depends, for example, on religious teaching, you know, we do what our religious books tell us to do, then that's a case of duty ethics. Now, in a secular society, that's obviously less popular than it was. But in a sense, we could be the gods for the machines. And I think they argue why they don't like that, but that would be one alternative for doing it.
I was also fascinated by the idea about whether I might be better at making ethical decisions than humans. Because after all, if you think about the famous trolley problem, in which there's a runaway trolley and it's going to hit five people and you have a lever which could divert it to hit just one person, should you move the lever and kill one instead of five? Well, if we program our computers to do the best for the greatest number of humans, then the program would definitely do that. But I don't think a human necessarily would. I think it would be quite difficult, for example, for me to do that if the single person at the other end was a member of my family, my brother, for example. I certainly wouldn't pull the lever. So maybe in that situation, the machine might be better. But he has another wonderful example about that, doesn't he?
Well, that begs the question about whether the famous trolley problem actually is a good model of thinking about ethics. And it's largely discussed within the context of utilitarianism. And I think that Nigel and Roger in the book are quite clear about utilitarianism not being the appropriate model of moral ethics to apply to AI. So I would be very worried to have AI as making these utilitarian calculations, because then it really just depends on the assumptions that you make going into those calculations.
But don't you think that everything that goes into these calculations has human bias? If we are biased in the way that we program the machine, or it picks it up, even worse, from learning how we behave to it, then naturally it might be biased itself.
So I think that's right. And I think the sort of drug of utilitarianism is that it appears, especially if you're a tech bro, to be a way of getting out of the ineluctability of there being value judgments. And what I like about the book is that they confront this, and they don't try and hide behind there is a mathematical approach to determining what is right and what is wrong.
And it's also very difficult to decide who's accountable when things go wrong.
Yes, that's a slightly different issue, which they don't really talk about a lot. Who do you sue? Do you sue the person who did the algorithm? Do you sue the person who is mounting the AI system? Or is someone else that you sue? I think if one looks at autonomous vehicles, where there is a lot of work, autonomous vehicles have a huge amount of AI, and there the legal process of deciding who is responsible is really quite advanced. And I think that there are issues in there that are more broadly applicable to AI.
Yes, although it's difficult if it's a program which has done a lot of learning on its own. So the thing that it comes up with, the decision it comes up with, may be totally unexpected and you have no idea how it got there. And it's not something which was programmed into the machine to begin with.
Yes, and there is a sort of subset of AI programs which not only come out with a decision, but try and explain how they got there. And I know that within the medical world, there's a lot of interest in that, because you want to know not only give this patient drug X, but you want to have some reason why. And there's a good example. I think they give a slightly different example in the book, but you can train an AI to recognize the image of a cat. So you can show an AI a picture of a million cats. So it's really good at recognizing what a cat is. But then you can do a sort of evolutionary experiment. So you can sort of alter an image of a cat to see what is a perfect concept of catness that the AI sees. And if you do this iteratively, you come up with something that the AI system thinks is the absolutely perfect cat, but looks nothing to us like our moggies.
Yes, and he has a comment there also about how machines were set up to talk to one another, and they ended up talking a language which certainly wasn't English. Yes. And nobody could understand anything. I think there's another problem which most people are nervous about, and that's privacy. Because, of course, we put vast amounts of our own data onto our smartphones and onto the web, and therefore it is actually accessible to lots of other people whom we might not even know might access it.
Yes. So Nigel's been interested in this for a long time. One of the things he's done outside outside his university career is set up the Open Data Institute, which has done a lot of good work in privacy. You mentioned that we at the Martin School have a program in this, which Nigel is one of the co-directors with Tim Berners-Lee. Mm. And there they are developing an architecture, and they talk a bit about it in the book, called Solid, which allows you to retain the majority of your data, but to expose just enough of it that you can get the benefits of the platform technologies. And it's something that has been taken up in some areas. I believe Flanders, the government of Flanders, are very interested in this and have incorporated in some of their in some of their IT systems. And it will be interesting just to see the degree to which it is taken up. Certainly when I've seen demonstrations of it, it looks a very good way of going forward.
I was absolutely fascinated to learn that Google has records of every search that's ever been made. That's quite extraordinary. And it also means they must have vast databases of this stuff.
It is. Actually, one of the things I like so much about this book, and the same authors wrote another book about 5 years back called The Digital Ape, which again looks at some of the challenges of AI, is that it is resolutely realistic about both the positives of AI and also the negatives of AI. So with privacy, then it says, yes, Google is looking at every single keystroke that you make. But Google looking at it is not the same as a human looking at it. And there is a real distinction there. Now, of course, it is possible that a human looks at it, but in many cases, a human is not looking at it. And that's an important distinction. And they stress a lot of the issues that we know that AI can cause at the moment, in particular biases. If you train it on one famous example, if you train a large language model or some other AI on a system where all the people are white, then it's going to give poor results for people from other races. So you can have these embed biases in it. But they are far more circumspect about some of the existential worries that people have said, that AI will be controlling us within decades. And they point out that actually being able to pull the plug out is still quite a good strategy. And in a couple of places, they wonder whether some of the concentration on existential risks of AI, which are coming down the line, might actually distract us from the issues that we have to do today with regard to things like privacy and inherent biases.
And not just privacy, I think, also who owns the data, because the large language models are they're trained on information that we have provided to them. And at the moment, there's a lot of discussion from artists and authors about whether this should have been the case and what benefit they're going to obtain from having done that.
And this is such a difficult issue, because if you or I write a small article and it goes into the on the web, then it gets sucked up and it's used to train these models. But along with a sort of trillion other bits of information out there. So it's not really we're losing anything out, and we're possibly gaining the benefit of getting a large language model. Very different case where you have an artist who has his or her own style, and then you have an AI that sets up to mimic that particular style.
It's quite tricky, isn't it? And I think it's interesting when you compare it to how printers work these days. So When you're writing a book, you are allowed to copy a certain amount of information from another book or a poem, but you're only allowed to do so much. And that, of course, is the difficulty with the large language models at the moment. They take everything.
There is a fascinating issue which they address briefly in a book called MAD, which stands for Model Autophagy Disorder. And the current generation of large language models trained on the web are now producing a large amount of material that is going back on the web. And so the next generation of large language models will be using a lot of text that's been produced by other large language models. And there was a paper actually in Nature last year analysing this and predicting that there will be a threshold when the whole thing breaks down because you're sort of feeding on yourself. And that is going to be an interesting challenge going ahead.
I hadn't thought of that, but actually that's a big concern, I think, because it's definitely a way in which you can propagate misinformation.
Yes, and it's not so much the misinformation, it's actually the structure of the text that the algorithmic statistical approach that large language models take just breaks down. And one thing that may happen as a consequence of this is that more specialized AI models develop, which are large, but not the mega large models that we have with ChatGPT. And there is research coming through that actually many of the incredible things that these models produce, you can get without the massive sucking in of the data. And that is quite it's encouraging in two ways. One is that you might be able to produce these models without being a Google or a Microsoft or a company that has the vast resources that is needed to run computers of a size to reduce GPT. So if that is correct, then it might democratize a little bit more the generation of these models.
Well, we're running out of time, but there is a couple of things I'd like to say. One of the things they don't seem to discuss much is the ethics of having the web there itself. But they do have this wonderful comment where they say that the cloud is used by millions of people to store their data, but it shouldn't be called the cloud. It should be called the smog because of the vast amounts of electricity it's consuming and the carbon dioxide which it's producing in order to produce that electricity and also the water. They didn't mention the water, but the heating of the water, which causes environmental damage. And then there's the mining of the rare earths and the metals and so on that are needed for our smartphones and things.
You're exactly right. It needs vast amounts of energy. Now, Microsoft, and I think it's just fallen through, but was going to build a nuclear power plant actually on Three Mile Island. And I may have this slightly wrong. Google is contracting with companies to do small modular reactors. So yes, it's not the cloud, it's the smog. Though it does remind me of, I think it was a joke in Private Eye of St. Peter saying, yes, when God asked me how to do rain, I recommended a cloud-based solution.
Well, to sort of conclude, I understand you think this is a wonderful book. I also think it's a very thought-provoking book, and it stimulated a lot of discussion with my friends and colleagues. And it's well organised. It's got a lot of interesting stories. I particularly like the comment that the World Wide Web could be considered as a human-machine cyborg in which human and machine intelligence are intricately entangled. I suppose eventually we'll end up with the chips in our heads instead of using our fingers to access the web. And I also thought it had a very good section at the very end where they come up with a series of seven proverbs or guidelines, they call them, on which we should consider how to produce the ethics of AI. One thing I didn't like much was that some parts of the book were in much smaller type than the rest, and it wasn't really clear to me why this was the case, and it wasn't easy to read.
I actually agree with you there. I was surprised but it's a typological infelicity rather than a major problem.
Yes, it's not a problem with the book. I mean, I thought the book was very interesting. It is, however, very dense. I wouldn't say that it's an easy read. You really have to sit and think about it. So it's not a bedtime read. But it's certainly a book which people should read.
Fran, I disagree with you. I read it in bed, so perhaps I need something heavier just to send me off to sleep.
Maybe you're much more intelligent than I am.
Certainly not.
Well, anyway, I think this is all we really have time for. So my thanks to my guest, Professor Sir Charles Godfrey. The books we have been discussing are The Fly Trap by Frederick Schurberg, not said correctly, published by Penguin in 2014, and As If Human, Ethics and Artificial Intelligence by Nigel Shadbolt and Roger Hampson, published by Yale University Press in 2022. You can catch up with more suggestions for a good science read on our podcasts, which can be found on the Oxford University website or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.